You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. This is The Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard, who is home with a bit of a cold today. But we're going to have a wonderful show. We have a number of great guests, and we're going to start with talking about the way technology has affected almost everything. iPods, YouTube, and MySpace didn't even exist when George W. Bush was first elected president in 2000. But as Garrett M. Graff points out in his new book, The First Campaign, new technologies promised to play a major role in the 2008 presidential race. His book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and I'm pleased it brings Garrett M. Graff to the show today. Now, you've called your book, Garrett, The First Campaign. Why did you choose that title?
Well, the title comes from the thesis that 2008, while technically the third campaign of the 21st century, will in fact actually be the first campaign of the 21st century.
Although some people would quibble and say 2000 wasn't the 21st century, but yes, that's true.
Technically either the second or the third.
Yes.
But that 2008 will be the first campaign where technology is both a medium and a message for the campaign. The candidates will be campaigning with YouTube and Twitter and online fundraising and blogging and podcasting and doing all of those things that didn't exist 8 years ago. But at the same time, talking about globalization and sort of the issues related to America's role in a global competitive economy that will probably drive public policy debate and our economy over the next 50 years. And that these are issues that we sort of haven't talked about over the last decade, but that very much need to be a focus of the next year's election.
Now, globalization is something that we've heard a lot about over the past, century probably, but in terms of technology, do you really feel that things have shifted so dramatically in just 8 years?
Well, what we now see is that on a whole variety of issues, there are issues of technology and American competitiveness mm-hmm. wrapped up in the topics that we typically think of as domestic issues. That 20 years ago, you used to have a healthcare policy that was domestic focused, or you used to have an education policy that was domestic focused. But that now, as a presidential candidate, if you're looking ahead, you need to say, well, one of the reasons that the U.S. is struggling economically to compete overseas in certain markets is because the United States is the only major industrialized country in the world that puts the price of healthcare in the price of the product. So, for instance, if you're General Motors, $1,200 of the purchase price of every GM vehicle goes to cover healthcare costs, which is actually more than GM spends for steel to build their cars. And so you sort of have the situation where you have businesses saying, in order to compete overseas, we need to fix the healthcare issue here at home. Or you have people saying, that they can't get the skilled workers that they need coming out of the U.S. education system and are having to turn overseas to find engineers or software programmers or the like. Over the last decade, in sort of the time that, as Thomas Friedman says, the world has gone flat, we've seen these threads of technology and globalization weave themselves into the fabric of society and culture in a way that they never have been before.
You know, I remember as a child listening to various campaigns and hearing about the world outside as well as the world within mm-hmm. our borders. And the thing that seems to have changed dramatically to me is the way people are talking about it and the tools that they're using to mm-hmm. talk about. As we look at this presidential campaign, we look at a style of debate, the YouTube debate, which we haven't seen before, so that you used to have people in the audience who could raise their hand and possibly ask a question, probably well-prepped, but here you've got videos of mm-hmm. people talking mm-hmm. about that. How do you see that shaping the way the conversation will happen in this campaign?
Well, what I think we saw, the Democrats had their YouTube debate in August, the Republicans had theirs last week in Florida, is that individuals sort of sending in these videos carries far more weight and gravitas than the anchors and the journalists who typically are the ones asking the questions in these debates.
You use interesting words, weight and gravitas, which are the things that people usually associate with anchors.
Yes,
so
exactly.
And you're ascribing that to the people who are sending these things in themselves.
Yeah, exactly. That we saw in the Democratic debate in August, you know, we saw a question come in from a Darfur refugee camp where they filmed it there and sent it in. We saw two lesbians who were asking sort of very pointedly whether the candidates would let them marry each other. We saw one man standing in front of the flags that belonged to his father and grandfather and his son, who were all killed in battle for the United States, and asking about the war and asking about sort of our military policy and foreign policy overseas, and that these were incredibly powerful moments that you would have never seen in sort of the typical town hall debate in sort of the sterile pre-programmed forums that we've gotten used to since the Clinton years.
Well, there's a vividness and a story quality to those videos that are different from an anchor saying so-and-so from such and such writes to ask.
Exactly. And we saw also that there was a controversial question from a snowman, an animated snowman in August, that Mitt Romney sort of roundly criticized, and he said he thought it was beneath the office of the presidency to have to answer questions from someone like a snowman about global warming in this instance. But I think that Mitt Romney completely missed the point, that it was, you know, it was a voter who put that animation together and asked that question through sort of the fun, lighthearted quality of this animated snowman. And that what we've sort of come to think of politics as something that has to be deadly serious and boring. And we're beginning to see some signs of life in these YouTube debates and with some of the YouTube videos that we've seen this year, where politics doesn't have to be boring. You know, these issues can be fun to talk about and discussed in such a way that people want to participate in this debate.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Julie Burstein, and I'm speaking with Garrett M. Graff. The First Campaign is his new book, and it's from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And you talk about the YouTube debates. You were involved in the internet at a very young age. In
yes.
your teens, you worked for Howard Dean, and you were part of his bid for the presidency. Did you, at that time, foresee the what you're talking about in your book, the kind of sea change in terms of the conversation that the internet was going to allow?
Well, I worked on the press side of his 2003-2004 presidential campaign, and at that time we knew that we were part of something new, and we were part of something that hadn't happened before, that sort of the aggregation of political debate on television was beginning to fall away, and that people were beginning to step up and participate and get involved and get active in a way in politics that they hadn't before. But that we had no idea where this was going at the time. We knew it was a great thing for the political culture in the country. We knew it was a pretty bad thing for sort of the party establishment. You know, we're coming into an era now where, you know, the party establishment will have the least control over this next election as they have in any election in U.S. history.
And why has technology played a part in that? Where do you see that equation?
Well, it used to be, you know, prior to the internet becoming sort of a major organizing tool, if I was living in Nebraska or I was living in Vermont where I grew up, pretty much anywhere that wasn't Iowa and New Hampshire, it was very, very difficult for me as an individual to play any sort of influential role in a national election. You know, I might be able to organize my block. I might be able to organize my neighborhood. You know, I might be able to flyer a couple of neighborhoods around me. But
you could drive some people to the polls.
Yeah.
You could do things like that.
But
yeah.
That now we have sort of this great wealth of voter-generated content that's coming out online, where these people are sitting at home and saying, I've got something to say. This is the issue that I care about. This is the way that I want to present this information. And they're going online and they're organizing. And they're putting out these videos. They're putting out websites. They're putting out blogs. They're using sites like actblue.com or slatecard.com on the right to sort of organize their own fundraising networks and raise grassroots money in small denominations that sort of aggregately add up in the way that whales can grow to great sizes feeding on microscopic plankton.
And that was one of the things that the Howard Dean campaign did that was so new in the early part of the 20th century. Yeah.
We had this one
21st century.
Yes. we had this
21st century was very different. But
one fundraiser in August of 2003 where Dick Cheney, the vice president, was holding a one-day one lunch fundraiser for 250 people in South Carolina, where he was going to raise $500,000, the maximum from 250 people allowed under federal election law. And we sort of turned to our grassroots network and said, we think that we can match him with small dollars. And over the course of 3 days leading up to this, we challenged our grassroots supporters to sort of contribute money and match this very small, high-dollar event that Dick Cheney was organizing. And we did it. We got something like 9,000 small-dollar donations, and we sat the governor down in front of the computer and on that Monday, I think it was, and he got a turkey sandwich from the deli downstairs, and it was sort of his $3 a plate fundraiser. And he went online and blogged with the people who were donating the money. And it was sort of this great testament that we don't have to rely in this country on a system where a very small number of people contribute a lot of money.
Money is one big piece of any kind of campaign. The other is the control over the way information gets out. And Howard Dean's campaign was one where some information got out that may have swayed the way people responded to him. In this day and age where bloggers are blogging immediately after something that happens, has that also changed the conversation so that something a candidate says is no longer private?
Absolutely. What we're entering what I call sort of the Miranda era of political campaigns, where anything you say can
and
will be...
And not as in Sex and the City. This
exactly.
is about the Miranda rights, yes.
Anything you say can and will be used against you, and probably by the time you're finished your speech. With cell phone cameras and small handheld video cameras, it's incredibly easy to videotape something and upload it. And so we've seen numerous instances already this year of video of gaffes or misstatements or awkward situations leaking out. And in fact, last year, there's a very good argument to be made that YouTube and sort of surreptitious or unsurreptitious video actually delivered the Senate to the Democrats in the case of Virginia Senator George Allen and Montana Senator Conrad Burns.
Can you talk about that and how you see that having such an influence?
Sure. George Allen last year was considered one of the front runners for the Republican presidential nomination. He was a very popular governor, popular senator, and he sort of had this famous macaca moment on the campaign trail where he called the opponent's staffer who was following him around and videotaping him what turned out to be a racial slur for people of Indian descent, which the staffer was. And it got online and it made it onto CNN and the national news networks, and it made it all over the local TV in Virginia as well. And sort of the irony of the loss last year was that if George Allen had in fact spent the last 4 months of his campaign lying on a beach in the Bahamas instead of actually being out there campaigning, he would probably be the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination right now.
So, when you go into radio or any kind of broadcasting, you learn quickly that whenever a microphone is around, even if you think it's off, you act as if it's on. It sounds as if our political candidates now have to believe that pretty much every waking moment.
Exactly. Now. And it will be interesting to me to see where that takes us, whether we sort of become immune to campaign gaffes, because once we've sort of humanized all of these people and realized that if you have these candidates on these punishing schedules, 18-hour schedules for basically a year, that they're just going to screw up a couple of times and that we will be more forgiving of those gaffes in the future.
Do you think that will happen?
I have no idea. What we've seen is that the most damaging gaffes are the ones that connect with sort of suspicions that people held previously. You know, one of the reasons that George Allen's video was so damaging was people sort of suspected that he was a racist to begin with. So once we had video proof of it, that really connected with people and really hit home.
I'm speaking with Garrett M. Graff. He's written a book called The First Campaign, and we're talking about how technology and globalization is changing politics. We have to take a quick break. I'll be right back. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Garrett M. Graff. He has written a book called The First Campaign, from Frauer, Strauss, and Giroux. Now, Garrett, in addition to actually now writing something that you can hold in your hand and look at, you are a blogger, and you were the first blogger to get official credentials to cover the White House. How did you go about doing that?
Well, it's actually sort of an interesting moment in blogger history. I was just starting a blog in Washington called Fishbowl DC that covered media and journalism in Washington. This was January and February 2005. And at that time, there was a scandal sort of brewing in the White House press corps of this reporter named Jeff Gannon, who had been sort of outed as a conservative, colorful character who didn't necessarily actually have any real business being a reporter in the White House. His stories sort of were a little iffy at best. His reporting credentials were basically non-existent, and a couple of bloggers accused him of actually being a male prostitute in his past, prior to suddenly one day appearing in the White House press corps for an organization called Talon News. And the White House's response at that time was, well, we'll admit anyone to the press corps who shows up and calls themselves a journalist.
You can nominate yourself.
Right. Mm-hmm. They sort of said, we're not in the business of deciding who is a reporter or who is not. We believe in the First Amendment. And if you show up and call yourself a journalist, you get to come in. And I said, well, let's see about that. So I, as a blogger, sort of started applying for credentials to cover the White House and got nowhere and was blogging about this and sort of the process and the history of the White House press credentials and how sort of different parts of Washington went about deciding who was a journalist and who wasn't. Capitol Hill has very strict rules. The State Department had very strict rules. Turned out the White House's rules were a little less strict than the others. But that it sort of ended up being this sort of three-week long story of, you know, whether I was going to be able to get in or not.
And what did you have to submit in order to get in? What did they require at that moment?
Well, at that point, it was a little unclear because there are two types of White House press passes. There's a day pass, which is what they say that anyone can sign up for. And then there's the hard pass, which is what you sort of get if you're covering the White House on a regular basis. And that's sort of a permanent credential. And I was applying for the day pass, which was the one that you really should just be able to show up and pass the very basic security check required of sort of anyone who tours the White House. And it ended up being sort of this story where sort of journalists in Washington started following it and bloggers elsewhere on the web started to follow it. And were sort of the conclusion that they were drawing was that Jeff Gannon was had gotten some special help in getting his credentials, because it turned out that it wasn't as easy as calling the White House and saying, hi, I'm a journalist, I'd like to show up tomorrow. And
I spell it with a capital J, actually.
Exactly. And what ended up happening was the head of the White House Correspondents Association, which is the journalist organization that sort of organizes the White House press corps, sat down with Scott McClellan, who was then the White House press secretary, and they had this conversation about sort of whether bloggers could be admitted as journalists into the White House. And what the Correspondents Association said, and I give them tremendous credit for saying this as sort of the gatekeepers of fine journalism in the White House, was that we don't want to arbitrate who can show up here. And so, you know, we really want to enforce this rule that if a person calls up and says, I'm a journalist, then they should be able to get in. And that's been sort of an ongoing debate across culture and media now, because if you go to typepad.com or blogger.com, you know, you can set up a blog and call yourself a journalist almost immediately. And that I ended up getting admitted after about two and a half weeks or so, and sort of setting the precedent that has allowed a handful of other bloggers since then to be admitted. The White House has sort of since settled on a rule where they'll admit anyone once, and then based on sort of the behavior of that person that first time, determine whether they will sort of be granted credentials on a regular basis.
Now, in that story, you talked a little bit about the kind of blurring of lines which your decision to pursue a press pass was part of, is that people expect a certain thing from, say, a newspaper journalist or a mm-hmm. magazine journalist mm-hmm. or a television journalist. Bloggers now have come in, and there's a very different level of conversation, and there's that ability to self-nominate. Okay, I'm going to say this, and I have now a way to say it to the world.
Yes.
How have you taken on that responsibility as someone who does this, and how do you see the kind of landscape of blogging out there?
Well, I think that... you know, my day job now is at Washingtonian Magazine in D.C., and where I sort of fit any traditional definition of a journalist.
Except you're wearing a suit and tie.
Yes.
So, but maybe because you're being interviewed. Not to say
I had to
there
dress
are
up
journalists
for radio.
Who do wear suit and ties. But.
What I feel like we in the media now sort of we get worked up over this conversation about sort of are bloggers journalists, you know, sort of who's out there impersonating us as serious, thoughtful, erudite observers of society and culture. But the truth of the matter is I think that misses why most people get into blogging, which is that they have zero interest in actually doing anything related to journalism, and that they want to write about their lives and what they do. I have one friend who has a blog here in New York, actually, that focuses on cupcakes. And my girlfriend actually has a blog that focuses on snacks. And these are the subjects that interest them and that they go online and write about and blog about. And that I think that there's a very small percentage of bloggers, Joshua Marshall in Washington at TalkingPointsMemo.com comes to mind, who are really trying to establish themselves as journalists who are worthy of the public trust that we in the media sort of like to think of ourselves as holding. But that for, you know, 98, 99% of bloggers, they're interested in opinions and their lives and their friends' lives and have little to no interest in actually sort of practicing the craft and the art of journalism.
But there are bloggers who would like to influence or comment upon our political dialogue here in this country and perhaps the political outcomes of mm-hmm. things. And what I'm often interested in is how, as a reader, do I discern what is, as you say, somebody's personal opinion about mm-hmm. something and what is a more thoughtful, reasoned approach to things. It becomes confusing as a user to look at this landscape and say, how do I discern what to trust and what not to trust?
The simple answer is there is no easy way to do that, that you sort of need to read something regularly. You need to see who is writing about another blogger online, and you really need to do some research before you can settle in on someone who is, you know, quote unquote respectable as a news source or not. What gets much more complicated in this is that bloggers in certain circumstances can certainly rise to the level of journalism. We saw some great sort of citizen reporting coming out of the London bombings or Hurricane Katrina or the South Asian tsunami, sort of natural disasters or man-made disasters for that matter, that thrust the people who are living in those areas into the center of a news story. And then as they write about their lives, sort of stumble into practicing journalism.
And it also allows for that level of storytelling and vividness that you were talking about, even with the YouTube debates, where all of a sudden a story is not told from a kind of omniscient point of view, but it's, this is what is happening to me right now.
In the case of the South Asian tsunami, the first photo published anywhere in the world of sort of that tsunami and the devastation was a cell phone photo published by a Norwegian paper that had been sent in by one of its readers who had been vacationing in the affected area. And it was just sort of someone who said, you know, here's a little piece of history and I can upload it to the web.
I'm speaking with Garrett M. Graff. He has a book called The First Campaign. It's from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. We're talking about globalization and technology and the upcoming elections that are upon us already and will be here in short time. How comfortable, we began by talking about the YouTube debates. How comfortable were the party officials with the idea of the YouTube debates? Was this something that was embraced by the different parties, or was this something that made them a little uncomfortable?
I think it depends on the party. The Democratic candidates were very quick to embrace it. The Republican candidates actually rejected it the first time. Their debate was originally scheduled for September, and only two of the candidates responded that they would attend that September debate. And it took a real strong effort by some of the Republican online activists and community to basically coerce and force the Republican candidates to participate in this YouTube debate that was rescheduled for last week when they all did attend. And I think that there is... There are some very interesting differences that I get into in the book at much greater depth between the two parties and the way that they are embracing and using technology at this point. But, you know, most of the enthusiasm and the energy and certainly the small dollar money is on the Democratic side right now.
How do you foresee that changing the kind of conversation that the Democrats may be having versus the one that the Republicans are having in this debate and in this election cycle?
Well, I think it's a big advantage for the Democrats going into next year's election that they have this online audience that's so fired up and energized and ready to contribute money. I think, though, as I argue in the book, I think it's sort of a larger problem for the country that we have one party that's very engaged online and one party that isn't. That the internet is going to be a defining focus of the U.S. economy for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And to have one party that, quote, gets it and one party that doesn't seem to quite get it is a huge problem for the decisions that we need to make in terms of all of those issues that we talked about at the beginning of the show: healthcare, education, broadband, wireless technologies, and all of that.
You alluded at the beginning to the issue of controlling information and that the internet is making inroads into the kinds of stories that candidates can tell. Do you see that as part of the resistance towards this new technology, is that it's more difficult to be able to shape the message?
It is. It's much more difficult to shape the message from both sides. But one of the advantages, I think, for candidates is that they don't have to rely on the media to speak directly to voters. And we saw this earlier this year when most of the candidates, especially on the Democratic side, announced they did it through online videos that their supporters were able to watch before the news organizations had even reported that they were officially running. Barack Obama sent out an email and posted a web video that most people who saw that video saw it before they'd even heard any of the reports from the traditional media that Barack Obama was running.
It's interesting because that moment in a campaign is such a piece, sort of a set piece of political theater, mm-hmm. where there is all of the conversation beforehand and all of the rumors and the reporters saying, we think that this is going to happen. And that in the Obama case and Hillary Clinton also, there were these moments where it was almost as if they were trying to stage manage their own first appearance before the world.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of this YouTube era, is that if Barack Obama wants to post a 4-minute video, people can watch all 4 minutes of it. It doesn't get chopped up into 10 seconds or 15 seconds on the evening news. That he can, you know, he can post. He gave a big speech at Google 2 weeks ago where he was actually talking about his tech policy that he would implement as president. It's a 64-minute video.
And if you want to, you can watch the whole thing.
And you can watch the whole thing. And, you know, I don't think since sort of the days of Harry Truman's whistle-stop campaign will as many Americans as will have the opportunity this year to see an entire presidential speech start to finish.
You, as we said, were involved in Howard Dean's campaign. You're now writing about this, which you're calling the first campaign. What do you foresee in 2012 will be the major differences between what's going on now and what we may anticipate in elections then?
I think it's nearly impossible to predict. One of the things that has been most interesting to me as I've been researching this and studying it over the past couple of years is that the internet has always happened to candidates, that they have sort of always been dragged along as this train has been pulling out of the station. And that even looking a year or 18 months out from an election, it would have been impossible to predict sort of what made the difference. You know, meetup.com and blogging, which were both hugely influential in Howard Dean's campaign, it would have been impossible. I mean, that technology basically didn't exist 18 months out from when Howard Dean sort of took off.
Right.
Last year at the beginning of 2006, YouTube barely existed. And it would have been impossible to say, you know, YouTube is going to be what changes the Senate elections in November, because sort of no one had heard of YouTube at that point. And, you know, looking ahead, 4 years, I imagine we'll have technologies that we can't even think about at this point. But I think that one of the most promising technologies out there is cell phones, that people will be able to get, you know, personalized directions to their polling place texted to them at 5 p.m. on election day as a reminder to go vote on the way home.
Garrett, you've been involved in the internet from the time you were quite young. You were a teenager. You have been blogging. You're now working at The Washingtonian. But as someone who's so steeped in this new technology, why did you choose to actually write a book that people can hold in their hands and read on paper?
Well, I think that the short answer is that the web is still not a very good place for long-form thinking and journalism. It is still not very pleasant to read a New Yorker article on the website at 10,000 words. And there are just sort of some subjects that require more thinking and more reflection and elaboration than you can really get into on the web. You know, a 4-minute YouTube video is an eternity on the web. And, you know,
you'd have to speak very fast to get your whole book
exactly
into 4 minutes.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the Leonard Lopate Show.
A pleasure
today.
To be here. Thanks for the conversation.
I've been speaking with Garrett Graff. He's the author of The First Campaign from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. We're out of time. Thanks again for being with me today.
Mm-hmm.